Welcome to the Loopcast, everyone. Today we are going to be talking about jihadi encryption. So this is an interesting topic, and it's kind of come to light a bit with the whole Snowden fiasco, which we'll get to a little bit more in the talk. But we're going to look at some of the historic events behind jihadi encryption and some of the topics and debates about it. So today I'm very happy to have Kryptia on the line, and he is going to be our expert today on this topic. So first, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So why don't you just walk us through the history of jihadi encryptions to start off with?
Okay, well, the one that I became most familiar with right off, you know, when they started throwing it out there was Mujahideen Secrets. Or if you're looking for it online, aswar.exe. And that, you know, I saw in the boards coming up more and more, you know, hey, you can use this if you want to email, you know, back and forth encrypted. It really didn't pick up a lot of speed. And actually, I went back today and I looked, and the first hits I saw on Mujahideen Secrets was around 2008 that it started showing up. And it really picked up speed after Anwar Awlaki was using it, as well as the media arm for AQAP in the Inspire magazine. They were using it to email questions to the leaders, and they would publish the questions and the answers in the Inspire magazine when it would come out. So that was the one that I was more familiar with, because they were really kind of pimping that one, saying use this. But because the groups are varying and they may not all play well together, other groups created other versions of encryption software. And so there was Asrar al-Darasa, and then Amn al-Mujahid. So, you know, those are the three. There's others. There's plenty of others. It's a big list, actually. A lot of them are based on the same kind of encryption algorithms, same kind of programming. But the top three are those three. The last one is by Al-Fajr. And that one, actually, is a new iteration, just came out in June of this year. And so, you know, they're all vying, they're all using it for their own purposes. That, you know, whether you're talking back and forth in email, or in the case of a couple of these, you could actually use them with Pigeon. So you could, you know, encrypt your session typing back and forth. So they've been around a while. I mean, 2008, it's a good long time ago.
Mm-hmm. And from their beginning to now, what kind of kinks have they had? I'm sure it hasn't been smooth sailing the whole time.
Well, like any encryption, it's not necessarily easy to set up a key, set up a private key, transmit your key, get the other guy's key, and do the same, you know, doing the key shuffle, basically. And for a lot of people who aren't really tech savvy, let's say, maybe they don't know how to install and run a Linux system, let's say, or, you know, if they're on Windows and they know nothing else, they need an .exe file and they need to double click it and, you know, install it. And these kinds of people, they're not necessarily very technical. So going back and forth and trying to create keys of the right strength, and then make sure that you get those keys to the other person and you get their keys securely and you keep them secure. That's the hard part. There's another angle to that of, am I going to trust this software that some guy is sending me, you know, to, they put it up on online on these sketchy sites and say, download this. And then I can just create my keys and do whatever. So it's kind of a crapshoot. You gotta know what you're doing in the first place to really know how to use it properly. That's the big thing.
So what are some of the general weaknesses or vulnerabilities that we see in these jihadi encryption programs?
Well, on average, the coding for them is kind of slapdash in some cases. So there may be vulnerabilities that could be exploited. I really haven't taken the time to decompile any of them and play with them. It's just not enough time in my day. But when you think about it, one of the things, like I mentioned a little bit ago, is who are you going to trust? You go to a jihadist board and they have a link to whatever uploader service that they put this file on for you to go get. How do you know that somebody hasn't tampered with that supply chain? I mean, do you know the person who's put it out there in the first place? Do you trust that person? Secondly, do you know that they haven't, that hasn't been interdicted in some way? If it's not somebody who's working for the government here, let's say, and uploading that file in the first place, how do you know that that user who did put it up didn't actually get interdicted somehow and a replacement put in that is actually backdoored? Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, the whole aegis of this talk is about the Snowden revelations. And a lot of the Snowden revelations is, you know, comes down to you can't trust anything. You can't trust anything because the government can get their hands on it, maybe backdoor it or tap it or what have you. So how do you know to trust the source when you install it? Is it, you know, backdooring your system? So there's that. The crypto algorithms generally have been pretty standard. There have been some deviations, but for the most part, they're using AES or Twofish or RSA. So, you know, you've got pretty common and sturdy encryption algorithms. So it's a matter then of how are they doing the implementation? How are you as the user doing your implementation of the keys and all of that? So that's another issue. And, you know, I would say there are further issues with a program, quote unquote, I'm doing the air quotes here. If you download a program and you do have antivirus on your system, you may find that suddenly that program no longer works because the AV is seeing it as malware. In the case of both the possible interdiction and supply chain tampering, as well as, you know, it being a program specifically put out there as a dangle to get people to install and then backdoor their systems, you can see in VirusTotals, and I actually sent you guys some JPEGs over Twitter earlier today for everybody to see, that VirusTotal was seeing a particular version of Mujahideen Secrets as malware. And it was being seen as malware by a lot of different AV vendors. So more than likely, one of two things happened. Either it did have malware in it, or it was just seen as malware by the heuristics of the program. So, you know, there's that. And I would say that just as a kind of a personal bent on it, you know, none of them are made for Linux. None of them are made for Unix. So it's all Windows. You'll have to depend on a Windows operating system, which, as we all read every day, isn't the most solid of security products, let's say.
So, I mean, looking at this and looking at the security factor, are these programs devised for beginners, people that really don't know what they're doing, as you said, but making it seem like they're not? But it sounds like if someone really knew what they're doing by creating these programs, they wouldn't create them that just ran on Windows and so forth. So what's the deal with that?
I think there's a general lack of expertise that comes from the venue and the audience. So my experience of all of these programs and the back and forth with these users has been in the jihadist boards that are on the internet. They're not in the dark net. These are just out there, PHP sites. You've got regular users who are, you know, Windows users, regular people. They're not technicians. They're not necessarily hackers, going to these boards to discuss jihad, and they may not be as technically capable. So you have to bring a tool that is at least point click install to get them to use it, right? The fear being, you know, post bin Laden getting whacked, things kind of got a bit tighter. Some sites went offline, retooled. You'll see it again when Heartbleed came out. A lot of them went down after they figured it out and you know, made sure that their systems were patched so they couldn't, you know, get exploited. So they are learning, but the general base isn't as technical as maybe they should be if they're going to be prosecuting online jihad, let's say. So you get these programs that are meant for them. They're meant to be just installed, do a couple of things. The hardest part for them usually is the two-key process. And you'll see that, you know, there was an article recently, last week, that came out decrying that PGP was broken and should be dead. It should just be gone. And when you looked at the article, much of the reasoning was around, well, it's hard. It's hard to do. You know, you got to manage your keys. You got to do this. You got to do that. And, you know, my response to that is if you can't do it right, don't do it at all then. You know, it's a perfectly fine working system. Sure, it can be a pain in the ass sometimes, but, you know, you got to deal with it. You got to learn. If you're going to run a computer, you should really know how to use it. It's like driving a car, you know, it's my opinion. But so I think it's really created for these individuals. So it's made simple. And even the encryption algorithms, while they are still, as far as we know, unbroken. In fact, the two-fish stuff that they use commonly is the same stuff that Schneier and company built in 1998.
So the algorithm programs that they're using really aren't state-of-the-art created on their own. It's more of material that's already out there that they're incorporating into these programs?
For the most part. Yeah, I have heard tell that there are at least one or two programs that are out there that have their own slapped together crypto, but I'm generally hearing that it's not great.
Mm. And then you referred to the keys when you're going to exchange encrypted emails with, say, your fellow jihadi. This is an example. What are some of the blunders that you've seen with these key codes and them exchanging keys?
Well, it's not like they can upload their public key to a key server like PGP does, right? You know, so I've seen keys, you know, public as well as private by accident on the jihadist websites. They want to transmit back and forth. They're not necessarily going to email their public key right away. I've just seen some messed up attempts where they've actually put their private key up. You put your public key out there too. I mean, public keys can be used to kind of track you around as well if it's out there. If you put it on more than one site, you'll know where they've been, mm-hmm. at least. Maybe who they're talking to. It's by inference. That's one of the problems with PGP and key servers is that if you upload your key to the key server and there are, you know, other keys that are associated with it, you can make inferential assumptions out of who you talk to because the keys have been back and forth or, you know, what have you. If you get into some system, you can see, you know, if you've got the public key in their keychain, then you know you're talking to them. Right. So there's been some blunders that way.
So looking at this idea of having your own encryption program, such as Mujahideen Secrets and so forth, are these types of programs a lot about branding? So the idea of being all about the social group and joining your fellow jihadis, do you think it's more of less of a security thing and more of a group bonding type experience? From the sounds of it, it sounds like you have these guys that some might be savvy with learning how to do the encryption, or they know what they're doing. Yet it sounds like the general emailing jihadi might not exactly be the most technically apt. So is it more a social thing, or is it also around this idea of having a more secure channel to communicate?
I think primarily by the operators, the people in charge of the sites, they, you know, the propaganda wings, they are more interested in the operational security and making sure that, you know, encryption is used in their communications. But they're also spinning it with, hey, you know, Al-Fajr has this. You know, we created our own encryption program, still using the same cryptography in the background. But they have a different image. You know, they've coded their own platform or taken bits of others in some cases. And in the case of the Al-Fajr piece, they actually, and I tweeted out earlier a picture of this, on the site, you can actually get a version that runs on Android. Now, I don't know what the security of that, because Android's pretty insecure for the most part anyway.
Right.
I wonder if Google looked at that. so, you know, they're getting a little more savvy as to, hey, you want to use your Android phone to do this? Cool. You know, and they're the only ones I've seen do that yet. The others haven't ported to Android that I know of. But as they move along, as they become more technically inclined in the sense that there's penetration of these types of devices and an understanding of it and reaching out to the wider audience, they'll spin it. But it'd also be the base idea is to have more secure comms.
And
that may be now. I mean, you're talking zeitgeist, right? So since Snowden started dumping his stuff, sure, everybody's, I mean, it's a no-brainer that you'd be saying, I need to make sure that my encryption is, you know, if I'm talking to somebody, I don't want the NSA to see it, right? So it's a simple thing. But to say, and this all comes from that Recorded Future piece, for me, that, oh my God, suddenly they're doing encryption. No, 2008, they were doing it. They were doing it all along online because they had the fear that they were being watched. And email is unencrypted. And it's not, you don't have to be a mental genius to figure that out.
So going back to the idea of if these people were using more mainstream encryptions like PGP or so forth, you know, they're going through all this trouble creating their own programs, and you pretty much laid out the reasons, but maybe for our less computer savvy listeners, why don't you explain the idea of backdoors, which seems to be the big fear. What is that? So explain it for our listeners that might not know what that term is.
Okay, well, backdoor is a piece of code that will allow someone into your system who you don't want there. So the common analogy today would be malware malware. If you think about all that you see in the news today, the stuff about the CHS, the health system that got hacked allegedly by APT, which is Advanced Persistent Threat, which means China in this case. All these users of this technology are just sending people bits of code that will install on the system and allow access to that system remotely. That's basically what it means. So what the fear is and why these guys are creating their own homebrew versions of encryption programs, the actual program to do the work using the algorithms that are already out there created and have withstood the test of time, is because they're not going to trust the software that they would say go if they're going to go get PGP. PGP is an American program. Phil Zimmerman developed it. I forget when it was like 90s, I think, and let it out on the internet for everybody. He got into trouble for that because at the time, encryption was considered a munition by the American government. But it's out there. Later on, it was bought by a company. I think it was Symantec. But the fear being that just like what you hear about all the Snowden revelations is that if it's a company that the NSA or the FBI can reach out to and maybe strong arm with a national security letter and ask for a backdoor to be installed, then it's game over. So they're not trusting that supply chain that I talked about earlier. So they're going to go and say, well, okay, well, Mohammed has created this. Great. I'm going to use that because I trust Mohammed more than I trust an American company who may be a puppet for the NSA. So that's their aegis.
So going back to these programs, I mean, you've got these guys using them, guys, maybe even women as well. Don't some of these programs create easily recognizable data to identify terrorist communications in organizations and, of course, users online? Because, as you said, you know, there are these people and they're using Mujahideen secrets or whichever made-up encryption program. So, I mean, to me, it seems like a great place to narrow down on individuals.
Yeah, if they're sharing the keys on the boards, let's say, where I've seen them, you know, share keys, or say they're sharing their keys on Hotmail. Well, Hotmail's Microsoft. I mean, really, it's not that hard for Microsoft just to give up keys, you know, give up the actual accounts that they're sitting on. If all the traffic's encrypted, that's one thing. Maybe not, you wouldn't be able to necessarily decrypt it unless those users made some really bad mistakes in implementation, or the creators maybe made some implementation errors in how they were using the algorithms. But, you know, you've got the email address, you've got the email container, you know who's talking to who because the email address isn't encrypted. The headers may have IP addresses where if they're not using Tor or some other proxy, bingo, you know. So the inferential thing is really a problem. So much so that, you know, even today, you know, if you're using PGP and you're just like me, you know, you're just a guy and I use PGP and I email somebody. Right now, the NSA, there's stuff that's out there from Snowden that says, hey, you use encryption, they're more interested in you. You know, in the big sucking Hoover sound that you hear, your stuff could be in there and something shuffles through it and says encryption. They'll flag it and they'll look at it later maybe, you know, decide whether or not who you're talking to warrants further investigation. So there's that, you know. No matter what you do, there's always going to be some portion of that, unless you've got some elaborate dead drop worked out that, you know, they don't know anything about. Maybe in the dark net, there's some mail servers in the dark net that might not be owned by the NSA that could work. And you could encrypt your traffic and nobody be the wiser. I mean, this is why they're hoovering everything. You know, it's a big drift net. I don't condone it, but that's the reasoning, you know, why they're doing it, along with the active attacking that they're doing. But on the CT side, you use Gmail, you use Hotmail, you use Yahoo, and you're trafficking in this stuff. You're actual email may be encrypted, but they're going to know who you're talking to, and maybe your IP address if you're not being careful.
So taking this conversation into a little bit of a different frame, where do you place the use of encryption in the larger frame of communication security and operational security? So things like financial and logistical security and where outsiders are brought in. How does that work?
Well, The real operators, I mean, a lot of them aren't really doing a lot online that's going to be caught. You know, when Bin Laden almost got whacked, he discovered that his sat phone had been compromised. So he went and after 9/11 disappeared. He was using runners. You know, maybe he was using USB sticks because in the pocket litter, they found USB sticks. But he also had a huge amount of, you know, laptops, hard drives and stuff. But it was all not connected to anything, you know, in his Pakistani bunker there. So if they're being smart and they're using tradecraft, they're not necessarily just hopping on Gmail and emailing. So there's that. There's a different operational level for those real guys who are in touch with the real baddies. Then there's the people on the jihadist boards that they're trying to, the media wing is trying to engage and get them to radicalize further. That's fairly open. I mean, the boards may be somewhat closed in that you have to be nominated now to get accepted into the board and get a, you know, pass and log and all that. But still, it's on the internet. You don't think it's going to be attacked or compromised because it's some badly implemented PHP site. You got to be joking, you know. So the level is different. The level set should be different because, like I said before, we're talking about average people who have internet connections and a Mac or a Windows box, and they're just getting on the internet and they're going to the site. Now, they have been getting better at putting it out there saying use Tails, use Tor. So a lot of that traffic going to the actual PHP server where this board sits is not necessarily getting their true IP address. So that's made it a little harder. But the encryption level thing, it's there. I don't think they see it as all important. Otherwise, if they really cared about their OPSEC, they wouldn't be doing it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at Al-Qaeda way back when, sort of their heyday before 9/11 and so forth, you really see the way that they communicate is much more, like you said, archaic. They have runners. They're you know, using burner phones, if they're using phones at all, and each runner has no idea about the next person. Everyone, it's just like one person knows something and the next person, and it seems like using the internet, of course, it's a brilliant tool for communications, yet on the other hand, as you said, it's very volatile to being intercepted, tracked, and so forth. So
yeah, I mean, they use Facebook a lot for, it's all propaganda stuff. Mm-hmm. Maybe if they're planning something, they might use a language encryption in the sense of, you know, kind of saying the raven flies at midnight, you know, that kind of thing. Drop the watermelon, whatever. and that we've seen them do that, even verbally over phone. So, you know, if you have more compartmentalization and you're using tradecraft, that's different. But these guys aren't necessarily doing that. So they may have Mujahideen secrets, but they could be sitting on a box that is Windows, you know, XP, no patches, and easily popped. You know, what's the value there? So they really don't understand the lay of the land, technically. Mm. And the NSA does.
Yeah. So how is the constant challenge to communication and operational security for these jihadis affected the organization of jihad as like whole, as a group?
Well, a lot of the mainstream stuff is still out on the net, and that's the propaganda wing and trying to get more people to give money or show up in Syria, let's say. You know, right now is, you know, the new Afghanistan, like we were saying before. So exhorting people to do things. The whole idea of Inspire was that, you know, trying to exhort the Western Muslim to action. But the core groups, they're doing their thing in country, and they may not touch a PC connected to the internet. In fact, they may not have infrastructure in some places to do it. The early days, I mean, when this all started right after 9/11, you know, really the infrastructure, a lot of the stuff was in like Peshawar for getting access to the internet. These guys were going to cafes, you know, and stuff if they didn't have money for sat phone and uplink, that kind of stuff. And so after it really became clear, and it's not just Snowden, there were other things that kind of came out over time, and they were worried about it, that the internet was just a little too open. They kind of backed off for the real operations. But if you do it right, you can do a dead drop online. I mean, well, what was that general that got in trouble last year, year before, for the affair? I forget it. Yeah, Petraeus?
His name eludes me as well.
Was it Petraeus?
I'm not gonna say 100% yes on that since we are on air. I don't know for sure.
There was the general who got in trouble. He was using a dead drop through Gmail with his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And because it was on Gmail, the FBI just went, give us the account, and they did. And they got all the emails because, well, they weren't encrypted. But what they would do is they would just log in, write a draft email, save it. And the other person would just log in later because they had the password and everything. And they just log in, read it, delete it, right? If they deleted it, I don't think they did. So that's the kind of idea of a dead drop. So sure, do that with some godforsaken little email company that nobody's ever heard of. So it's always possible, but it's not a mainstream thing.
So looking at that, I mean, could you say really that the real bad guys, so the real top leaders, the people that are really planning things, they're not going to be using these encryption programs necessarily. It's more for what I like to call the armchair jihadi, the wannabe jihadi, the person that, you know, is supporting whatever group it is, let's say ISIS or Al-Qaeda. So the guy that's supporting, but from afar, would that be?
I think that's a fair
way of explaining it, maybe almost.
Yeah, I think it's a fair estimate, but I think there's also the possibility that there are some that are using it in select ways, trying to be under the radar. And, you know, an occasion of that would be Alaki. Alaki was talking to the guy who shot up the base in Texas, Nidal Hassan, over Mujahideen secrets. Mm. But I will caveat that Alaki was doing that as part of a propaganda to get Nidal to do what he did. Right? So there was no operational detail, as far as I know. I'm not privy to all that. But, you know, whether Nidal wrote him an email with the secrets and said, this is what I plan on doing, what do you think? Then it was just a back and forth of, hey, I'm the imam, you know, you should be radical about this because, you know, they're killing Muslims and you're in the army there, you know. So there's that. So there may be some that are using it, but I don't think it's more of a mainstream thing. If they were really wanting to be secret about it, they wouldn't be publishing it online for everybody to attack. Because if you're uploading it and you're saying you're uploading it to, you know, some uploader site, that's asking for somebody like me or somebody else to come along and say, well, let's redirect that traffic to something that's already been owned and infect them with malware.
Mm-hmm. So
compartmentalization is big.
So have you actually seen other than Awlaki, have you seen other pretty savvy jihadists using these encryptions, or are they so savvy that we don't know about them?
Well, they may be quiet. Mm. There are some guys on the boards who are known players, but I have not seen their keys, and I've not seen them discuss, hey, let's go talk about this, you know, with Mujahideen secrets. For most the time that I see them, they're on the boards and they're talking, giving direction, you know, to people, saying, well, this is why you should be doing this, or this is how you should be doing this, or be careful of this, or touting when things happen, you know, usually putting out the, you know, like the video that was on the YouTube of Foley's execution. They would be on there pimping it out. Mm-hmm. They're just throwing it out there. They're not saying, let's encrypt this. So it's quite in the open. And I can't say for sure that there aren't some of these guys actually using PGP, or they went and they got GPG from SourceForge. But I haven't seen too many of these guys running Linux. The hacker crews are a little bit less radical. It's changing. But, you know, the Islamic hacker front, you know, kind of started really with the Syrians anyway. You know, the pro, earlier than that, Team Poison. And where that leads to now is Trick, who was with Team Poison, who got popped for stealing the Prime Minister's of England's emails and contacts and stuff and publishing them. He recently got to Syria and is tweeting on a Twitter account, as of the last one I saw was the 28th of July, that he's in Syria and he's working with IS. And the fear is that he may be helping others within the milieu there to learn how to hack and how to do more of the online type of work that IS is kind of savvy about. You know, their Twitter campaign was pretty interesting. And though Twitter would try to tamp them down, they came up with innovative ways to deny Twitter with scripted processes, and in one case where they set it out there so that they had a program that could tweet by other people's Twitter accounts if you allowed it. So all these people were tweeting IS propaganda because they had allowed their accounts to be used. So it was this huge megaphone, and that was pretty savvy on their part. So that's the worry that I have right now, is that IS, which has a good campaign online, might become more technically inclined and do more things.
And do you think because of this, these new developments and how savvy IS is with their internet skills, social media, and so forth, do you think we're entering into a new era of jihadi communication that might be much harder to track and much harder to possibly contain?
If they get smarter about their OPSEC, you know, OPSEC is hard. It really is. You can always make a stupid mistake, and that one thing could lead your downfall. A while back, years ago, there was a kid who was teaching hacking, and he was doing YouTube videos. He was a Muslim hacker, but he kind of had jihadi affiliations, and he was teaching how to hack and do credit carding. But he, you know, he made a mistake. It was a simple, stupid mistake, but it still popped him. And that was that in his YouTube videos, I watched them all, and I finally found one that he had his real IP address in the command line. So I knew exactly where he was. Passed that along. But everything else, he had Tor. He was doing all kinds of things, you know, to try to proxy out and make it obfuscated. But he still made that one mistake. And that's what will be your downfall. So unless your OPSEC is perfect, you will always make a mistake. So even if you have crypto It's not the panacea, you know, it's not the thing that's going to make everything okay. You will get caught eventually because you make mistakes. You're human. So I think that's the thing is like they may learn more tricks, but they still are, you know, human and they'll make a mistake.
Mm-hmm. So we've been looking at jihadi groups per se right now, but where do we factor in the lone wolf? So we hear about the concepts and ideas of lone wolves a lot of the time in the news. Every now and then we have some sort of attack that, you know, this whole talk of lone wolves pops up. So where do they factor into all of this?
Well, the Inspire magazine really was aimed at the lone wolf, this idea, radicalizing individuals outside of the lands, quote unquote, to action. And over time, as you know, all those Inspires came out and they had things in them, you know, hey, why don't you go get your F-150 and put blades all over it and then run into a crowd. You know, that was one of their ideas. In between all the exhortations and the Quranic verses, you know, they tried, but over time they kept grappling with it and they could never really get a toehold. Right. So in the States, there have been there have been a few people that we've heard about who have either tried to leave the country or got stung by the FBI. Now, there is a report out recently about some of those stings and how a lot of the times the FBI kind of made their own jihadis. Where they picked up on these people, I'm not sure. Maybe some of them were online on the boards. I know of one in particular that was. And he kind of self-radicalized, but he was also mentally unstable to begin with. So you've got this propaganda going out there trying to get these lone wolves to energize, and it really just hasn't happened in the way that they would like, let's say. And I haven't seen a whole, you know, huge shift of people trying to go to Syria. But in the UK and in Europe, different story. It's happening more. And with IS, we've seen it happen even more lately with British recruits, as well as other European recruits going. And it's not because the, you know, Inspire magazine is out there either. I mean, the old issues are out there, but that is kind of defunct now. There's some other magazines that are, you know, trying to get it out there, but they just don't have the same pull as the Inspire did. So, yeah, I think that the change is that it's really with ISIS or IS, and we'll see what happens with that. But suffice to say that it was hard to get to Afghanistan after we invaded Afghanistan. It was not hard to get to Afghanistan in the 80s when UBL got there and others teamed in to fight the Russians. Now you've got Syria, and it's a free-for-all. So they're all going to Syria because they want to test themselves. That's where they're going. They want to be lions. They want to go to Syria. They want to fight in the jihad. So if they radicalize because they see it online, they try to go, they go. But I have other theories about that. You know, I don't think necessarily that a single individual in his basement is going to radicalize to the point of actually going and doing it. I ascribe more to the group of guys theory than anything else.
Mm-hmm. So we talked, I alluded to at the starting of the talk, but let's bring the whole Snowden leaks in here, because this is something that, as you mentioned, there's been a number of articles about this, and Curtis Wallen has put forth the idea, and I'm going to paraphrase here, that the Snowden leaks revealed a deep but ultimately narrow band of information from which to adapt against. And in their move to adapt, the terrorist cells will change security procedures and thereby mess up because they do not possess the whole picture. So let's look at this and the Snowden leaks as a whole.
Yeah, well, I think, like I said about OPSEC and COMSEC, these are hard things to kind of just thrust yourself into if you haven't been trained. These are things that are military as well as, you know, espionage things, tradecraft. And you get trained to do that. So unless you have, if you're, you know, in the West, unless you've got somebody really training you or you have a good manual and you really, you know, practice it, there's going to be screw-ups, right? So the mass of people who are out there online talking about this stuff, maybe radicalizing, are not necessarily getting taught about OPSEC. They're not necessarily reading about OPSEC. They're not sitting down with a manual, let's say. And there are manuals out there. I ran into one years ago that was basically a clone of another military operational field operational manual for intelligence gathering, humans, tradecraft. The translation was funny, but, you know, basically it gets the point across. Now, how many of these people are actually sitting there practicing it? How many people are going out and actively trying to evade a tail? You know, I don't think that's happening as much. If in the early days when they had the camps, AQ had camps and stuff, maybe they were teaching that, and they were teaching tradecraft, but it's not something you just pick up online and you're able to do it without any serious training. So I think Snowden's documents that have been released show a very wide breadth of how the government via the NSA is tapping into everything. And when you look at it from the perspective of somebody in InfoSec, somebody in this area, you know, that understands how this technology works, and the security angles of it, it's hard to say that anything you do online, even with good encryption, even with good operational security, is going to save you. If they want you, they're going to get you. My friend Ali said it, and, you know, it's, if you're going up against a nation state, you're not going to win. So there you have it. I mean, all these guys out there, they're going up against a nation state. You either got to keep it, you know, small and off the grid, or there's a likelihood it's going to be picked up by the giant ear.
So this concept out there that the Snowden leaks and Snowden in general has helped the jihadis, because you hear articles about how, oh, all of a sudden they're scrambling and changing their encryption programs and so forth. I mean, how realistic is that? Is that just a bunch of hype, or is there some reality to it? Let's hear your thoughts on that.
I think it's a gross generalization. I think they've been, you know, like I said, they've been using encryption since 2008. Anybody serious about it, so we'll be using it. So the serious operators will be taking time, being careful. The general people that are out there maybe wanting to get in on the action aren't going to do that. So I don't think that it's changed their operational tempo that much that we should be, you know, like freaking out. But yeah, at a certain level, it's going to change their habit. I mean, it's changed my habit. You know, I encrypt stuff more. I try to use Tor a little bit more. And even then, you know, you look at what's going on with some of this de-anonymizing and toxic black hat and stuff like that. You're like, well, crap, you know, What do I do now? You know, I might as well just step away and write in a journal somewhere in Pig Latin. You know, it's, that would be more secure. So I think for everybody, the slate has been kind of changed and we all have to adapt. That adaptation necessarily now, these guys are, you know, maybe more people are using Mujahideen Secrets, it's RSA, or they're using the other products, which are Twofish. And those, like I said, are solid encryption programs. Maybe there's problems with the program that they've developed. Maybe there's supply chain tampering. So, you know, what they think they have isn't what they think they have, and they've got a backdoor. Or, you know, they're, the main thing is that they may be using encryption, but all that OPSEC stuff, the failures there will lead to their downfall. So no matter what, I think it kind of equalizes out. You know what? It's just general things that have been said, like they're tapping the fiber. They're putting stuff into routers. They're doing this, doing that. It will make people think twice, maybe, but in the end, it's not going to make that much difference.
So I think the key things I've learned in this conversation is that basically OPSEC and tradecraft are someone's best friend or their worst enemy, depending on how savvy they are with it.
Yeah. I mean, really, if you wanted to have a private conversation, let's say, and I can't say that it's going to happen now because of that facility in the desert, right, in Utah, because everything's getting, you know, siphoned, put away, and then will be looked at later if they need to, right? So, but if you wanted to do it, you would somehow talk to your compatriot, let them know to buy a burn cell phone. You would buy a burner cell phone. You would power it up. Make that one call because you've synced numbers somehow other than that. Make one conversation and then throw it away. And even then, because you've used, if you're in the United States or even out, because, well, you know, the NSA's pwned everything pretty much, that's probably going to get recorded at some point, right? So they could go back to it later. If they look for a time frame, if they find out that the individual in question was in this particular area, triangulate the cell phone, you know, find that person and then go from there and go back to the recording. So you'd have to be talking in code on top of that to have some other layer of protection. It gets insane.
It really is amazing. It's just so deeply layered and entrenched that, as you said, it's almost impossible. And nowadays, with all the technology we have and that we rely on every day for everything.
Yeah.
Although I do admit, carrier pigeons, they seem like the future here. Go back to the birds.
Go back to the birds with encryption.
Yeah. Exactly. There you go. Encrypted bird messages. There you go.
Well, they found one in a chimney. In England, a year or two ago,
okay.
And it was from World War II. It'd been dead, you know, obviously, but they went to try to decrypt the message because nobody was really around anymore to be able to decrypt it, and they finally did break it. But, you know, it's interesting. So, yeah, hey, why don't we try that?
So we always like to give our guests a moment to maybe touch on something we might not have touched on or have a final say to conclude the talk. So I'm going to hand it over to you.
Okay. Well, this whole talk really kind of boiled over because of Recorded Future and the reporting around that. Because when Recorded Future reported that jihadis were using encryption post-Snowden, oh my God. They kind of glossed over some things. They really didn't do a lot of digging. They didn't even think about the OPSEC thing. And I wrote a piece about it because it's just, you know, fear mongering, really. It may be interesting, yada, 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 but you know, this thing ended up on NPR, and in the mainstream media. And then later on, Greenwald came along and said, well, Recorded Future is a front for the CIA in Kutel. So there, that all blew out of proportion. When I wrote my piece, people from Recorded Future were, you know, trying to talk to me. I'm like, go away. I don't want to talk to you. You know, you did a bad job, so go away. The reality is that everything is possible, that there are bad guys using encryption. It happens every day. But to think that, for the most part, these people who are on these boards who are propagandizing the war, the jihad, are the big threat, kind of disingenuous. A guy that I know who will be listening to this, and I shall not name him, calls the boards the 4chan of jihad. And I would agree with that assessment. There's a lot of dirt that goes on. So there may be people who are in the background who are doing real things, real bad things, who are using it. But I think those people who really have more of a sensibility of what the implications are of the security issues are not using these methods. They're not going online and just emailing back and forth with, you know, Muhammad on Gmail. It would be just fundamentally stupid. And if they're doing that, please, please do go ahead. I hope you do. And then you get popped. The Reaper drone will be there soon. So, you know, always look at the mainstream media's portrayal of what's going on with a grain of salt. That's what I have to say. So this all came about. I'm glad that I could talk about it and kind of go over what I know from what I've seen and others that I talk to, and have a different dialogue than, oh my God, you know, this is amazing. No, it's been going on since 2008. It's not a big deal.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and we will actually post that link to the piece that you wrote, kind of revving up towards this talk. Thank you so much for your expertise and your discussion on this, because it's been a great learning lesson for me, and I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot too.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And take care.
Thanks, you too.